Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
There are better alternatives to seclusion and better ways to implement restraint than was happening in the district for many years.
The Justice Department finds that the Anchorage School District illegally restrained and secluded students. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, February 16th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Matsu parents are struggling to find alternatives as the school bus driver strike passes 2 weeks.
My wife had to, you know, resign from her job, and we went down to one income because of no child care available to get our kids to and from school.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
By the beginning of next school year, the Anchorage School District says it intends to completely end its practice of locking away students with behavioral issues. The practice is called seclusion in education policy. That and the practice of physical restraint were the subjects of a 2-year investigation of the U.S. Department of Justice that led up to a legal settlement announced today. Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea has more.
The settlement commits the district to a 3-year plan to eliminate seclusion and improve its practices around restraint. The Justice Department says the school district repeatedly and inappropriately secluded and restrained students with disabilities, resulting in illegal discrimination. These practices are supposed to be limited to emergency situations, but the Justice Department says the district used them to address student behavior often enough that some students lost a lot of instructional time. The Justice Department says some Anchorage students who were subjected to seclusion hurt themselves, and expressed suicidal ideation. During a news conference Thursday, Anchorage Superintendent Jarrett Bryant addressed the Justice Department's conclusions.
The district denies and refutes the claim that ASD was discriminating on the basis of disability, but regardless, we do completely agree with the DOJ that there are better alternatives to seclusion and better ways to implement restraint than was happening in the district for many years.
Tarlisha Wayne, Senior Director of Special Education for the district, described what some of the existing purpose-built seclusion rooms look like.
There's a room that has a door as well as a lock. At our sites, there are also cameras. The room does not have anything in it as it relates to furniture or anything. As it relates to that, it is just a small space for a student who has posed imminent danger towards themselves or others.
Under the old seclusion policies, she says staff is supposed to be right outside, monitoring the student's safety and needs. She says a student is only supposed to be locked up until the imminent danger has passed.
Those times could range anywhere from 15 to 30 seconds to several minutes. It all depends on how escalated the student is and if we're able to assist that student with calming down.
Federal investigators base their conclusions off of reviews of policies, procedures, incident reports, and interviews with district employees. Bryant says Anchorage was one of more than 40 school districts across the country that the Justice Department investigated. It's led to at least 5 other similar settlements since 2017. Many of the reforms in the settlement are aimed at 4 specific schools: Cassoon Elementary, Lake Hood Elementary, William Tyson Elementary, and the Whaley School. These schools all have programs for students with special needs and challenging behavioral issues. In a memo, an attorney for the school district noted that these schools use seclusion so often that they were national outliers in the data. Bryant says other commitments in the settlement include dismantling seclusion rooms, staff training on other ways to manage students' behavior, and creating a new staff position responsible for implementing, documenting, and monitoring compliance with the settlement agreement.
The vision is to move in a new direction and to move away from the practices of seclusion and to dramatically reform restraint. So we need to prioritize investing in training and whatever it takes to ensure that staff understand what their new tools and their toolbox will be to help students in distress.
The district says that someone has already been hired for the new position of Assistant Director of Intensive Behavior Supports. Her professional background is in special education, mental health, and behavior. The district also launched a webpage with more information about the settlement and its seclusion and restraint practices. The site includes a contact email that is specifically for questions and comments about these practices. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
Thousands of Matanuska Sioux Sitna Borough students have now gone without bus service for more than 2 weeks, and there's no end in sight. Bus drivers continue to strike over their contract. The company that employs them says it won't return to negotiations for at least a week. For families caught in the middle, it's becoming a big problem. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early reports from last night's crowded school board meeting.
Kent Scheibel is a father of two and told the school board that the strike has had a huge impact on his family.
It's been really rough on us. My wife had to, resign from her job. And we went down to one income because of no child care available and getting our kids to and from school.
Scheibel was among dozens of parents, bus drivers, and community members who packed the school board meeting. They told the board of issues ranging from complicated carpools to access for special needs students to safety on the buses. Most who testified blamed the operator of the buses, Durham School Services, for the ongoing strike. That included Kenneth McClamrock, one of many drivers decked out in bright chartreuse safety vests.
We're told by our dispatch from Durham, warning lights come on at the dash, your check engine comes on, your ABS comes on, your wrench in a triangle comes on. Keep driving. Keep going as long as your gauges look good. We drive until the buses shut down.
The driver's strike started January 31st, and contract negotiations came to a halt last week when Durham officials abruptly ended a negotiations meeting after presenting their last best offer to the union. An email from regional Durham official Will Zimmerman to the union suggested meeting again, quote, in a week or two to learn if setting a new bargaining date might be fruitful, unquote. That means 6,000 to 7,000 of the district's students will continue to have no bus service indefinitely. MATSU Superintendent Randy Traney says the district is in an impossible spot. Community members have called for the district to terminate the contract with Durham, but Traney says it's not that simple and it wouldn't immediately end the strike.
If magically another contractor came in like magic, like literally with magic, and they had 160 buses and you'd still be negotiating a contract with a new place.
He also says there could be legal issues with the abrupt cancellation of the contract, and the school district may not seem like a good place for other contractors if they canceled a 10-year contract 6 months in. Even before the strike, Durham had been the subject of controversy with rolling bus cancellations and failure to get proper permits before they began operating in the MATSU. Edward Flavin, spokesman for Durham parent company National Express, says the company has been working with the school district to ensure it gets the proper permits. In a statement, Flavin wrote, quote, "We were new to the state of Alaska when we started operations last year and worked quickly to understand and comply with all that is required to operate here," unquote. Flavin did not respond to questions about bus safety complaints. Traney says the district can't interfere with the contract negotiations directly, and there's not a lot it can do to hold Durham accountable.
The way that we can hold Durham accountable is through the contract. That is our mechanism.
At the meeting, Traney presented a list of alternative transportation options. The suggestions included reconfiguring bus services to have longer routes and fewer buses, and opening school earlier and later in the day to better work with parent work schedules. Other suggestions were providing gas cards to families who now have to transport their kids, or getting rid of busing altogether.
I'm sure everybody has an idea they hate on this list. The idea was to get information out there for you all to think about.
In the meantime, parents will have to contend with difficult transportation arrangements as the strike continues on. Parent Audrey White says she's been driving 6 kids to school, up from her usual 3, to help friends. She says she's concerned over safety issues and access for students.
I have a special needs son who, according to his IEP, is supposed to have services and doesn't. But with everything that I am finding out that the bus safety and my brother who drives buses down in the States, I wouldn't put my son or my daughter back on those buses until they're fixed.
During the strike, district officials say 2% of students have been absent, and the district is seeing 6 to 7 students a day transferring out of a MATSU school. Reporting in Palmer, I'm Wesley Early.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating the legacy of Elizabeth Paratrovich.
Our people need heroes, and we were not permitted to have them for many years.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
An Anchorage woman charged with murder in 2019 after getting caught up in what prosecutors described as a catfishing scheme has pleaded guilty. Denali Bremer was 18 when she and two fellow teenagers were tricked by an out-of-state man who offered them millions of dollars to sexually assault and kill 19-year-old Cynthia Hoffman. That's according to charging documents filed in both state and federal court, which say Darren Schillmiller, then a 21-year-old from Indiana, posed online as a millionaire and convinced Bremer to send him photos and videos of child sexual abuse. Prosecutors say Schillmiller promised Bremer and her group $9 million to kill someone in Alaska. The teens allegedly bound Hoffman, who reportedly thought of Bremer as her best friend, and fatally shot her near Thunderbird Falls north of Anchorage on June 2, 2019. Bremer, now 22, pleaded guilty Wednesday to first-degree murder. Bremer's sentencing is set for August 22nd. Her plea does not come with an agreement on the length of her sentence, and the sentencing range for Hoffman's murder is 30 to 99 years in prison. Schillmiller was arrested and extradited to Alaska, and now 24, remains jailed on murder charges in the case. That state case and a federal child pornography case in which Bremer is also charged remain open. A legislative resolution in support of Alaska's salmon troll fleet has cleared its first hurdle, although it has a way to go before seeing a full vote in the Alaska House and Senate. House Joint Resolution 5 is the first piece of legislation introduced by Sitka Representative Rebecca Himshute, who was elected to a first term last November and sworn in this past January. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
House Joint Resolution 5 was heard in the House Special Fisheries Committee on February 14th, Valentine's Day. Representative Himshute used the day as a springboard to focus attention on Southeast trollers whose livelihood has been jeopardized by a lawsuit in the federal court in Seattle.
I want to start by wishing everyone a happy Valentine's Day. And if there's one thing Alaskans love, it's our fishermen. So we're going to talk about some fishermen today.
Himshute and co-sponsor Ketchikan Representative Dan Ortez are the only two Southeast Alaskans on the Special Fisheries Committee. Himshute explained the significance of the troll fleet to the other members.
You'll find trollers in every community of Southeast Alaska. I don't know if there's a community without at least one troller, no matter how small the community. So it's a very important fishery for Southeast Alaska. And 85% of the trollers in the fleet are Alaska residents. So these are people who are hook and line fishing. So when they put their line in the water, it's a very sustainable fishery. They're going to pull up a salmon. This incredible homegrown fleet of fishermen doing the hard work that brings in about $85 million to our economy in Southeast Alaska is under attack, and they've been attacked by the Wild Fish Conservancy. There's a lawsuit that started in 2019, and this resolution is going to urge state and federal agencies to continue defending our trollers.
Although the Southeast King Salmon Fishery is the target of the lawsuit, the defendant is the National Marine Fisheries Service, which oversees the management of the nation's commercial fisheries. In broad terms, the Wild Fish Conservancy argues that NIMFS violated the Endangered Species Act when it failed to fully account for the impact of Alaska trolling on the food supply of a population of endangered killer whales in Puget Sound. Although experts believe that NIMFS can correct this supposed error, it's now in the hands of a federal judge in Washington whether or not to shut down trolling for king salmon in Alaska until it's remedied. Other members of the committee tried to tease out a better understanding of the problem. Committee Chair Sarah Vance of Homer asked Alaska Trollers Association Director Amy Daugherty if harm to killer whales was an ongoing concern.
Has there been concerns about impact to the orcas prior to this?
Never. In fact, it's our understanding that every other orca population up and down the coast is healthy and, in fact, increasing, except for this localized Puget Sound population.
This is probably the most incongruent aspect of the lawsuit for trollers, who regard themselves as an environmentally sensitive fishery. Shutting down commercial trolling for king salmon in Alaska may not have any effect at all on killer whales in Puget Sound. Sitka troller, environmentalist, and fisheries advocate Eric Jordan could barely contain his frustration.
This existential threat to close down our southeast troll fishery in a fundraising charade by the Wild Fish Conservancy is a brutal assault on us that won't save one orca. It is the most vicious, misguided assault I have witnessed in a lifetime of experience with fisheries conflicts.
Tad Fujioka, board chair of the Seafood Producers Cooperative in Sitka, argued that the Wild Fish Conservancy lawsuit failed to accurately trace the problem for Puget Sound's killer whales. If it did, the line would lead right back to Puget Sound.
The black salmon isn't really the problem that the southern resident killer whales face. If it was, we wouldn't see that the Alaskan and British Columbia orcopods growing so steadily. The real problem for southern residents is the pollution in Puget Sound. You know, there's 5 million people that live in the Puget Sound area. With all the heavy pollution and road runoff, it makes the local fish toxic. The Washington Department of Health recommends that people eat no more than 2 servings of Puget Sound king salmon per month. And of course, the local killer whales eat a whole lot more than that. And that's made them some of the most contaminated marine mammals anywhere in the world.
The House Special Fisheries Committee unanimously passed House Joint Resolution 5 out of committee. Its next stop is the Rules Committee, where it could be scheduled for a floor vote. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Initial election results show Soldotna's Peter Michicki with a commanding lead in Tuesday's special election for mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough. But as KDLL's Sabine Pooks reports, the borough won't know until next Tuesday whether it's enough for the former Alaska Senate president to win the four-way race outright.
As of the most recent results, Michicki had just over half of all votes cast, with ballots counted at all precincts except for Tyonek. The results also don't yet include all absentee votes, which officials say could come in at a higher rate than usual due to the timing of the special election. The borough will be counting absentee ballots through next Tuesday. If Michicki's lead stays above 50% as the remaining ballots are tallied, he wins. If it falls below, the borough will hold a runoff election between the top 2 vote-getters next month. Michicki is holding his majority by just 23 votes, and acting borough clerk Michelle Turner says the borough has received 1,700 absentee ballots so far. Michicki says regardless, he's been grateful to see the solid base of support from precincts across the Kenai Peninsula. He thinks it helped that he spent time in communities of the peninsula that sometimes feel voiceless at the borough level.
I spent a lot of time in the small towns of the Kenai, making sure they knew that they won't feel like a stepchild in the future.
Michicki previously served as mayor of the city of Soldotna and was most recently president of the Alaska State Senate. Linda Farnsworth Hutchings is in second place so far with over 17% of the total votes. Farnsworth Hutchings sits on the Soldotna City Council and is the accountant at Hutchings Auto Group. David Carey, a retired teacher who also sits on Soldotna City Council and was previously borough mayor, has 11% of the vote so far. Zachary Hamilton, an Air Force veteran and co-owner of Brothers Cafe in Kenai, has nearly 5%. Robert Wall of Sterling is running a write-in campaign for the mayor's seat. About 16% of votes so far were cast as unresolved write-ins, according to the borough's results. The winner of Tuesday's election will serve through the next regularly scheduled municipal election in October. The seat has been vacant since the resignation of former borough mayor Charlie Pierce last summer and is currently filled by interim mayor Mike Navarre. Michicki says if he does win, he'd like to follow up on plans for a borough-wide working group, which would get feedback from constituents on borough services. Just a heads up, that's his family's dog, Colonel, barking in the background.
That's my final message, is for folks to get ready to volunteer and engage, because I think it's important. They're the key to our success. It's not someone sitting in a borough building somewhere. It's the constituents being willing to take part in their government to make it better.
Voter turnout borough-wide is just over 9% so far. That's low compared to 18% turnout at the municipal election back in October. If no runoff is necessary, the borough will certify results of the election next week on February 21st. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on. On Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska. Are you an Alaska artist or do you know one? March 1st is the deadline to apply for a Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Award. The program provides awards to artists, musicians, performers, writers, and culture bearers. Amounts are increasing. A project award, now $10,000, is available for an Alaska artist at any career stage. Mid-career and established artists may apply for a $25,000 artist fellowship. Learn more at Rasmussen.org. Rasmussen Foundation, promoting a better life for all Alaskans. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
Alaskans across the state today celebrated Elizabeth Baratrovich Day in honor of the Thlinget woman whose speech before the Alaska Territorial Legislature changed the course of history. The year was 1945 when lawmakers debated what would become the nation's first anti-discrimination law. The turning point came when Baratrovich stood up to a senator who demanded to know why people barely out of savagery should be considered equal.
I would not have expected that I, who am barely out of savagery, would have to remind gentlemen with 5,000 years of recorded civilization behind them of our Bill of Rights.
These are words written and performed by actress Diane Benson, who used newspaper and witness accounts to reconstruct Baratrovich's speech. Words that even today resonate with her granddaughter, Betsy.
Just reading it just kind of sends shivers through your body just at how well-spoken she was and how she basically called out people that didn't want to vote in favor for the law and did so eloquently.
The anti-discrimination bill was signed into law on February 16, 1945, almost 80 years ago, a day that years later became Elizabeth Baratrovich Day. Betsy Baratrovich says many other Alaska natives fought for civil rights alongside her grandmother and her grandfather, Roy. But somehow it was Elizabeth Baratrovich's story that became a defining moment.
Our people need heroes, and we were not permitted to have them for many years.
Baratrovich says she's glad to see the growing interest in the Alaska Native civil rights movement and the hunger to learn more about a time when Native children were sent to segregated schools, when families were kept out of white neighborhoods and couldn't eat at restaurants where there were signs that said no dogs, no natives, all forms of discrimination that became illegal on this day in 1945. Shipping trash off-island is expensive in Southeast Alaska. In Wrangell, almost a quarter of the sanitation department's budget goes to shipping and processing garbage. Now the tribe's environmental office is piloting a new composting program it hopes will help reduce those costs eventually. And as KSDK's Sage Smiley reports, it might also help residents grow their gardens.
Years ago, Wrangell's community garden was a baseball field. Now planter boxes fill the diamond in neat rows and the old concession stand is packed with gardening supplies and a powerful smell.
So strong.
A little bit of a funk.
Oh my God.
Valerie Massey and Kim Wickman make up the two-person environmental office of Wrangell's tribal government. They've helped lead the resurgence of Wrangell's community garden, fueled by a group of committed locals and a $17,000 grant from the state. Much of that money went to purchasing a small community composting machine, the source of the smell, which has taken up residence in the old concession stand. The machine is about the size of an airline snack cart and can turn 20 pounds of food waste into around 2 pounds of compost in a day. Wickman walks through how the machine works, noting they're using an old Wrangell post office scale to weigh food scraps.
We put it in the machine, you close the machine, you go to the back, turn on the breaker, come back out, hit the start button. And it makes all sorts of lovely noise and scares everybody and some funky smells. and 24 hours later, you have compost.
Wickman says there are two big reasons composting food waste is important on an island like Wrangell. One is what makes up Wrangell itself. The island has terrible soil. Adding compost can make it friendlier to plants. The other reason, she says, is how expensive it is to ship trash off the island. She says a survey the tribe carried out about 4 years ago found that almost half of Wrangell's trash could be composted.
All of our trash leaves the island. So we pay horrible amounts of shipping to get our food here. We consume our food, and then we pay horrible amounts of shipping to get it out of here, where it gets loaded onto a barge, it goes into a truck, it goes onto a train, and it ends up in Oregon somewhere. This can help cut some of that weight. We start cutting some of that weight. Hopefully, we can start cutting some of our cost. We start cutting our carbon footprint of sending all these things out, while also giving the community soil. So it could really be a win-win on all aspects.
Cutting down on shipped waste could be a big financial boon for the community of Wrangell. Every barge container shipped down south costs the 2,100-person community thousands of dollars. Wickman says creating compost is somewhat of an art. There's got to be the right balance of dry and wet ingredients, carbon-rich dead material, and nitrogen-rich living material. So they're setting up a compost collection program with the hope that it might help them learn the ropes and yield some compost and some data. 20 Wrangell residents are part of the compost collection pilot. They've been given buckets with instructions for what can and can't go in the machine. Yes to fish bones, veggie scraps, and eggshells. No to large bones or compostable bags. Artist Mad Hessler is one of those 20.
I'm a gardener, so compost is great for my garden, and it would be sweet for there to be more compost in this community for us gardeners to use, because soil is really expensive here.
She's been collecting compost to drop off at the slow, cold composting site at the community garden for years, but says she was excited to join the pilot. The way she sees it, if composting is more accessible, more Wrangellites will give it a try.
And I want the community to know, or the tribe, I guess, to know that people are interested in this. I mean, it's like so much food waste on this island, and it's nice. I mean, we can't recycle or anything, so we might as well be able to compost our food scraps.
Massey says that although this type of composting is helped along by a machine, the goal is to redivert some of Wrangell's waste back to the island, a decomposition cycle that happens naturally in the forest and ocean.
It is the way of the future, it's the way of the past, and now we just have to make it the present. That's the only missing piece, so that's what we're trying to do.
The first weeks of the compost pickup pilot program have been a little bumpy. The machine blew out a blower fan, which paused pickups for a couple of weeks, but with the fan fixed, Massey and Wickman say they're ready to get back to grinding. In Wrangell, I'm Sage Smiley.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Jeremy Shea and Rhonda McBride in Anchorage, Wesley Early in Palmer, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, and Sage Smiley in Wrangell. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Madeline Rose is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.